So a few years ago, my sister-in-law got married and her husband asked me for some advice. You see, he's an only child and his family isn't that close. And he was marrying into a family with five kids, three in-laws, and a bunch of grandkids. And on top of that, the extended family is kind of massive and actually pretty close to each other considering how many people are in the family. And since I had also married into this family and had been a part of it for almost 15 years, he wanted to know if I had any advice for him on how to be part of this family. What's it like? What does he need to know to fit in? Are there any unspoken expectations that he should know about? You see, joining a new group, any new group, means learning the norms and the customs and sometimes even the rules, spoken and unspoken, of that new group. When I joined the Boy Scouts as a kid, I memorized the Scout Law and swore an oath that I would try to live up to it. If I wanted to be a scout, I had to commit to a certain way of life. When I graduated from high school and I went to Point Loma for college, I signed a behavior contract. If I wanted to be a student there, I had to commit to a certain way of life. When our girls signed up for their soccer teams, they committed to following certain rules, right? They have practices and there's an expectation that they attend and are present and are ready. There's also an expectation that they are good sports women. I don't know how you make that inclusive of everybody. Kind and respectful to other players on the field. And then last week, Derry stood up in front of everyone, and she committed to living out a certain way of life as part of our church family. In a culture where commitment really doesn't mean that much, and where faith is often treated as a private matter, Derry committed to living out a certain way of life as part of our particular community. Just for a moment, I want you to consider your own experience with this. So, like, what group, any group, have you joined at some point in your life? And sort of nod it when you have it, so I can see that you're kind of thinking about it. Some group, family, otherwise, that you've joined. Looking for some nods. We've got some. Okay. Now, can you just think of one rule or expectation or requirement that you were obligated to follow because you were part of that group? Anyone willing to just share one real quick? Yeah.
When I joined a cooperative house in college, we all had to do a house job.
Okay, everybody had a house job when you lived in a cooperative house in college. Carol, I think I saw your hand.
Yeah, when I joined ACC, we had to not talk about
our company. Okay, when you joined a business, you couldn't talk about your company negatively on social media. Nice. Yeah, Kim. Yeah. Okay. Well, so when Kim got married, there was an unspoken expectation that she would wear a dress to church on Sunday morning. Very specific. Anyone else have one? Some rule expectation for a group that you joined? Okay. Well, yeah, Charm. Yeah, Charm is part of a group called Partners for Change, and there's an expectation that you contribute in some way, serve as part of the group. Avery, did I see your hand? Oh, just a yawn? Stretch? That's okay, good. So you can see these are all like different kinds of groups and commitments. How do you feel this morning about our passage? Our passage from James tells us that we are expected to do a bunch of things. These don't come across as suggestions, right? But instructions. We're told that we need to be doing the law of liberty. Our passage this morning tells us that it's not enough for us to simply hear Jesus' words, to be reading the Bible, to be showing up in church and hearing what Jesus had to say. We are expected, according to James, to do them. Which brings the question, right? Well, so, okay, what exactly are we expected to do? And James gives us a list, though it's kind of a small list, at least at this point. We are to be people who can control our tongues. We're to be people who visit orphans and widows. We are to keep ourselves unstained from the world. And we are to refuse to show any partiality. It's how most translations translate it. Ours this morning said favoritism. James expands a bit on like what this partiality might look like, elaborating when we treat two people differently because of how they look, we're showing partiality. So for James, you cannot treat the rich among you better than you would treat the poor. James sums all of this up under what he calls the royal law, another phrase for the perfect law, the law of liberty. And he sums this up as love your neighbor as yourself. So if you have your Bible open, if you're taking notes, like you should underline this, scratch under it, note it, whatever you need to do, right? The royal law is at the very center of our passage this morning, and it is at the very center of our lives as followers of Jesus. But James continues to elaborate on what this law looks like in practice. He says that we're actually also expected to show mercy to others, and we're expected to do something when we see a person who is hungry or naked, that we can't simply wish them well or offer to pray for them. We are expected to feed them or give them clothes. Which brings us to James's big closing number. He says that any faith that is disconnected from a certain way of living is ultimately dead. That it's empty. It's meaningless. Because as James says, even the demons believe in God. What is your faith good for? If you believe that Jesus is the king of the cosmos, yet you don't then follow his royal law. So I'm curious, as you've listened to our passage, as you've heard this bit of an intro to our passage, how you find yourself measuring up this morning. Like, are you willing to assess yourself? Maybe give yourself a quick score. A letter grade for each behavior that James lists. Taming your tongue. How much control do you have over what you say and what you don't say? Visiting orphans and widows. Do you visit them? Who and when? Keeping yourself unstained from the world. Where are you on the scale of spotless to just plain nasty? Treating people without distinction. Do you ever treat people differently? Because of how they look? Because of how they talk? Because of how they're dressed? Because of their size, skin color, their age, whatever it would be? And then showing mercy. What do you think of those who have obviously failed? Who have fallen short? Who probably don't deserve your kindness? And then finally, meeting the needs you see. How often do you actually do something about the needs that you see around you versus how often do you notice needs and then move on with your day? I don't want to assess myself. So my girls just recently finished a trimester at school and we got their report cards. And I've shared this before, but it's always funny to me how different the girls' report cards are between middle school and elementary school. Not their performance, but the structure and the format. Becca's report card just has each of her classes listed, and for each class she's been given a grade, A to F, and then a couple teachers provide maybe a comment or two. But then for Kate, she has this long list of state learning standards. And then next to each standard, there's a letter indicating whether Kate is meeting that standard, exceeding that standard, or behind the standard. And then her one teacher will offer some comments on Kate's work and how she can continue to grow as a learner. And I find Kate's report card far more helpful. Right? It's too easy to get a passing letter grade and be satisfied with that and not actually understand the subject matter. And so maybe this morning you gave yourself a C in a particular subject or even a D on maybe controlling your tongue. Because if you were honest with yourself, your words are a little out of control. Maybe you frequently say things without thinking. You're constantly offending people or sharing too much, either about yourself or others. Or maybe you gave yourself a low grade because you actually rarely say the things that you should be saying. So you pass on every opportunity to talk about Jesus with people and rarely say the kind or encouraging word that's necessary in the moment. But you gave yourself a passing grade because you try. And that's kind of the problem, right? A letter grade doesn't like tell you much. And we all know that you can just keep getting passed along with C's and D's. It's much harder to let yourself off the hook when you use a standards-based assessment. Controlling your tongue might be a single subject. And then under it, there are these clear standards which you either meet or you don't. And if you don't, then you can honestly face that. And James expects you to do just that. We read this earlier, but let yourself hear it again. In chapter 2, verse 10, we heard, if you show partiality, not like a little bit, not like sometimes, if you show partiality at all, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the law but fails in one point has become accountable for all of it. James then gives this quick example, saying essentially, like, if there are two rules, you can't neglect one of the rules and then think you get a pass because you followed the other one. James is offering a hard teaching for those of us who intend to follow Jesus as king. It's a hard teaching, right? Because according to James, there's no grading on a curve. There's no A for effort. There's not even a D just for effort. There's no, well, controlling my tongue just isn't really my subject. Like, if you can't control your tongue, you don't pass the class, which means there's more work to do until you can. If you can't be impartial, you can't move on or move up. until you can. And James just says it real matter-of-factly. You are guilty of these wrongs. You are falling short of loving your neighbor as yourself. And love for neighbor is the goal of it all. So just for a second, right? Notice, how does all of this make you feel? Like, who's feeling the guilt right now? James, unfortunately, would just say, good. Like, you should feel guilty when you are guilty. Notice what James says in the very next verse. Verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12. He says, so speak and act as those who are to be judged under the law of liberty. Speak and act. Or as James said earlier, do. Don't just hear. James is making it really simple for us. We are to look at the perfect law, the law of liberty, the royal law, and we are to say and do what it says. If at any point we get lost in the details and we forget what the law is about, what Jesus wants us to be doing, it's all summed up in one phrase, love your neighbor as
yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus is forming a community, a family of love. If you want to join the family, this is what you're signing up for, to be in a family that will love you, will try to love you, and will keep getting better at loving you, hopefully and probably. But you are also committing to be in a family that you are committing to love and to grow in your love for. And James just says it, matter-of-factly, listen, if you fall short of that standard of love your neighbor as yourself, you're guilty. I don't think we like the word guilty. But he doesn't stop there. Don't live in your guilt. Don't wallow. Speak and act as people who know that you're being evaluated according to this standard. He says, if you find yourself guilty, then start doing whatever it is that you're guilty of. And I want to acknowledge, this like might feel really heavy, but I want you to hang with me for just another minute because I believe that there is life here. James says, you will be blessed if you do the law of liberty. Do we really believe that? Where does this blessing come from? Where is it found? And maybe more important, what is this law of liberty that James is referring to? Well, the law is of liberty in two distinct ways. First, the perfect law, and this is a really important distinction, the perfect law is something that we receive, we have been given, only after we were set free. So, Jesus died 2,000 years ago. Quick question, when were you saved? Somebody tell me when you were saved, just shout it out. No. Where else? 2,000 years ago. Yeah, that's the answer I was looking for. Good. We tend to think that we got saved the moment we prayed a prayer. No. Like, salvation was enacted, made for us 2,000 years ago. It was done before we were ever born. The devil has already been disarmed. Our chains have already been released. Like Israel, brought through the Red Sea, we've already come through on dry ground. This means that none of this, what we say, how we treat the poor, whether we visit orphans and widows, none of this has the power ever to save us from our sin or from death or from the devil. We don't do any of those things to set ourselves free. God doesn't love us because we do these things. He didn't die for us because that we've been good enough because we did these things. God loved us and gave his son for us. Already, amen. And he brought us out of our slavery to sin and death and the devil. This has already happened. And only now, recognizing ourselves in the realm of freedom, does Jesus give us instructions on how to live with each other. Now that we're in the family, Jesus tells us how this particular family is to live well and love each other. And he's really honest with us. If, as part of this family, you don't love your brother or sister well, you don't love your neighbor well as yourself, then you're guilty of that. But that, and that guilt doesn't undo Jesus' death, but it just names the growth that you still get to undergo. So the law of liberty is the law that we are given as free people. But there's a second way that the law is of liberty. And so think about the story of Israel again. Set free from slavery in Egypt, God tells the Israelites that they are never to enslave each other. Think about what God's doing. The Israelites are free, but they've carried with them into the land of freedom some of their very habits and ideas and customs that they learned as slaves. In fact, they were enslaved for so long that these are the only ways that they know how to live and be in the world. And so the law that God gives them is a law that they can only receive once they are free, and it's a law that will help keep them free, keep them living free. See, their temptation will always be to go back to what they know, to cling to their past, to enslave each other and their neighbors, and ultimately to re-enslave themselves. But God gives them a law, and that law will help them to stay free. This is what the law of liberty does for us. We were slaves to a world that valued people based on arbitrary distinctions. We don't have to go far to see those distinctions at work in every part of our lives in the world we live in. But Jesus announces, James is convinced of this, we have been set free from those distinctions, from the power of the world. And so James tells us, we should stop interacting with each other based on the distinctions that our neighbors are making. That we must refuse to treat the rich any better than the poor. Why? Because these distinctions keep us enslaved, even though we are actually free. To resist, to refuse, to love our neighbors, rich or poor, young or old, from any tribe, tongue, or nation, as we love ourselves, is to be free. But we will fail. A lot. Over and over. And when we do, we'll be judged as guilty. But guilty doesn't mean punishment. Our guilt doesn't disqualify us. It only names the work that's still to be done. And James says, mercy triumphs over judgment. We have received God's mercy. And thus, judged as guilty of not loving our neighbor as ourselves, we have been loved by God and given another chance to love as we have been loved. This is mercy. And God didn't show us mercy once. Our lives are covered in his mercy. The way that our kids' lives are covered in mercy as we parent them and walk with them as they grow into maturity. And as we consider mercy, now is as good a time as any to remember the mercy of God, to meditate on it, and to receive it as we come to the table together.